The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by Fulfill.io. Imagine for a minute that you had a central business brain that looked at every facet of your e-commerce operation, shipping, ordering inventory, accounting, everything to help you make better decisions, not just about growing your top line revenue, but about being profitable. If that sounds compelling, you should check out Fulfill.io. They're the only cloud ERP designed to help you efficiently and most importantly, profitably scale your eight or nine figure brand. They do that through better forecasting, smart supply chain planning, identifying operational bottlenecks that you can go in and solve to open up the full potential of your business, and also a really powerful and incredible warehouse management system for reduced misships and mispicks for better customer experience. And they're the highest rated ERP among e-commerce fuel members, not NetSuite, not Skubana, not Odoo, but Fulfill. So if you're interested in growing, but growing profitably, you'll definitely want to check them out. And you can do that at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by OneClick Upsell, the most popular, largest upsell app in the Shopify marketplace, trusted by over 11,000 users, over 1,900 of those big spending Shopify Plus stores. And they've generated over $200 million in revenue for the merchants that use them. And you may be thinking, oh, hey, Andrew, I've heard of OneClick Upsell. I know these guys, but do you really? Do you know what they've rolled out recently? They've got some cool new stuff for their pre-purchase and their post-purchase upsells. You can now select from multiple different offers to present your customers. So instead of having them just have to pick from one single thing, you can give them the option to pick from multiple upsells, which helps and has proven to increase the number of people who actually take you up on those upsells. So if you're not using upsells in your store, it's an amazingly easy, fast way to increase your average order value and your revenues. So check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure e-commerce brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today, joining me on the show is a longtime ECF member, Kelsey Larrick. He is the man, or one of the men, behind 365 Holdings, which is a holding co, which with a number of e-commerce businesses, I think nine at this point, eight figures in revenue. And we're going to be talking about how he's built this business. We're going to be talking about how he structures it, his kind of approach to capital, what he calls durable capital, why the holding co model, because it seems we're going to be getting into that, because it seems like it has its challenges, any business does, but the holding co model does. He also has brought a very cool thing into the world, Hold Co Conf, which is a conference for holding company operators, something that he did his first inaugural conference last year. So we're going to also be talking about the distressed M&A world, a ton of good stuff to go through. More than anything, you're just excited to geek out with this man because he's a smart guy. And I feel like we've never really had a chance to go deep on stuff, Kelsey. So very much looking forward to this. And thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Long time listener and first time caller. So appreciate you having me.
Yeah, this is going to be fun and appreciate it, man. We got to start. The most important place, of course, is the bobblehead doll of yourself that you have. You posted this picture to Twitter, I think. What's the story there? How close do you think the likeness is to your own? You got to give us some context. And we'll post this in the show notes because it's pretty funny.
Great. That's exactly where I hoped you'd start. So I did not post it. Yeah, the media team does have access to my social media, and occasionally I get burned. Earlier this year, we did a transaction where we ended up buying a brand that has a manufacturing facility overseas, and we make custom plush products. And doing some R&D, my business partner, Justin, who runs our day-to-day, thought that the best test would be to take a picture of me standing in his office and send it over to the factory that makes many things in plush and to see if they could clone Kelsey. And so he keeps it in his office. He calls it his little friend. I think it's a voodoo doll that from time to time he stabs with sharp objects. But that was an R&D project that was not supposed to go on social media. And I'm very glad it's going in the show notes. So thank you for that.
Any way I can help, you know, with the Twitter following here, Kelsey, happy to do it. It's funny. The reason that stood out to me so much was because years and years ago, and I won't necessarily name names here, but one of our ECF members that was a great contributor and still is a wonderful person, we were giving out an award. And so we came up with the idea to make a personalized bobblehead for them, right? And so we sent it out to him. We thought it was hilarious and funny and interesting. And anyway, we sent it, never heard any reply. months went by, and I think we kind of just forgot about it. And then I think I asked him about it 6 months later, and he said that was the weirdest thing that has ever happened to me. I opened it up, and it was slightly scarring. I threw it away, and I've never seen it since. So it just, yeah, bobblehead galls, personalized, maybe aren't the best gift if you're trying to make a, person.
The gray hair is a little too accurate. I was hoping they'd be a little kinder with the coloring there, but this is my life.
All right. Now that I totally dug that up and probably lost half our listeners here, 365, talk a little bit about this. Like, it's obviously a holding company. For those who aren't familiar with that term, a holding company is kind of a Warren Buffett-esque, like just any kind of umbrella company that operates lots of independent sub-brands. You've got 9 brands at this point. What was, generally don't dwell super long on origin stories on the show, but in, you know, maybe the real nutshell version, how do you guys get started with this?
I don't know if I've ever told you this. I think I've said it publicly once or twice, but this is actually great timing for you to ask this question. Honestly, some of the original inspiration was interviews you did years ago with both our friend Bill D'Alessandro at Elements and then Shaquille Prosla. I think they were some of the first people kind of rolling up e-commerce. And it was probably right around the time that Justin and I, my business partner, just happened to buy an e-commerce business. I don't think that we had a thesis for e-commerce. We didn't have a background in it. We just wanted to buy a business that we thought we could operate. We thought we could get it financed. We were comfortable with, had good cash flow. Like, we were just opportunistic buyers prior to e-com. We had service businesses. We had like a little portfolio, but no real scale. There was a handful of businesses that were 5 and 6 figures and no team, no office, no infrastructure. But we buy this first e-commerce business. And literally, it was some conversations you had with Shaquille and Bill where I was like, oh, maybe a portfolio of e-commerce one day. And now I'm happy to call, you know, both Bill and Shaquille friends, which is kind of cool. Because literally both of them were inspirational with interviews you did with them years ago. So I appreciate that. But fast forward to today, and it's been 6 years and change, a lot of hard work, maxing out SBA loans and taking out some high interest loans from time to time. A lot of hard work from the team and a bunch of good luck. But we've rolled up 9 brands across the portfolio. We've not raised any outside equity. It's just privately held by Justin and I. And the team today is a little over 100 if you count like VAs and global contractors, production employees and whatnot. We do some in-house manufacturing. And so in headcount, we do have vertically integrated production team members that are in that headcount. Our US-based Akron, Ohio, in the office 5 days a week crew is like 35 or 40. And we do our own pick pack. And so beyond that 35 or 40, there's another 30 or 40 in the office and the warehouse. And then the rest are global. Yeah, it's been quite the ride to get there.
Wow, that's amazing. And 6 years, that's not a real long time to build something like that up with that team and that revenue size that you've gotten to. This is 9 brands. Do you have is there a certain vertical you stick to or a category, or are you kind of agnostic when it comes to what you'll buy?
We've been incredibly opportunistic, and I'm happy to buy good businesses at fair prices. I'm also happy to buy fair businesses at really good prices, and we've done both. Like every good entrepreneur, you go and you put together a business plan or projections of some kind for a business. And I don't know about yours, but all mine go up and to the right, and they always look great. And what we've noticed through time is that we have a dispersion of outcomes. So much like a venture capital portfolio, you get like a barbell effect where you just get some outliers. And we had them kind of honestly in both sides. We've had some sizable purchases that have just gone not great, fine. We've had some small purchases that have gone to the moon, and which we've done really well with. And so I'm constantly kind of reevaluating my ability to project out, you know, the winners and the deals we should do. And we've really kind of come to that decision that kind of at bats and time in the game seems to be a theme from our careers. And I can think about biographies of like titans of industry that point to good fortune, good luck, and time in the game as part of their keys to success. I think we're just kind of scratching the surface of that. So we'll remain opportunistic as long as there's good cash flow and ability to finance these transactions. And I'm hopeful maybe at some point we get a really outsized opportunity or a winner. But in the meantime, our aim is to find really high quality businesses that have some defensible moat, some amount of high quality revenue that we think is durable. And then we just want to give it a great home that we can operate it, have it be profitable, have it make great products for its customers. And the businesses themselves should be good things in the world that are solving people's problems and delivering value. And if we can build a portfolio of those, I think we'll do just fine along the way, even if it's not some tightly knit story around baby or outdoor products or pets or whatever. Commonality is these are all consumer products businesses that primarily go to market via e-commerce. And then our real passion or niche would be to vertically integrate them as tightly as possible. So I prefer proprietary products, proprietary manufacturing, things we can pick pack ourselves, we're really going to control as much of that value chain as we can. We think those are the best assets that we can own and operate in the space.
Interesting. You mentioned something interesting, like the great business for a fair price, or a fair business for a great price, right? Like the, you know, paying up for good stuff, or bargain basement, turnaround kind of distress kind of things. When you look at the deals that you have done, in those nine in your portfolio, or ones maybe that haven't made along the way, which one of those, my gut reaction is that paying up for the good businesses would be the better approach. And let's not look at it from a heartburn perspective, because obviously the more distressed deals are going to have more heartburn and more trouble. But from an RRR and kind of like return on the time and the hassle approach, my gut would be that paying up for the good businesses would be the better long-term approach from just a returns perspective, controlled for stress. Is that fair? Or have you had a lot of success? Is kind of the reality different based on what you've closed and the deals you've seen?
Our sample size is pretty small, and we've not been at this long enough. Also, the timing of us doing this coincides with like the rise of the venture-backed aggregator. And so there's some, I think, distortions in the market between zero interest rate policy, aggressive buyers that were funded on a venture capital predicated model of, you know, growth to the moon. And so I think we're still early in e-commerce. And again, we have nine. We've sold one along the way. I don't know that I have a good sample size. I do think you're right. In the long run, good businesses at fair prices is probably the most enduringly repeatable way to do business. But as a high-strung, go-getter attitude entrepreneur, I'm not very patient for that always. Along the way, when good opportunities come up, like I've got a lot of reasons to want to chase them down. And so honestly, I think we've done better with the unexpected, more rocky, more operationally intense, more distressed, lower purchase price, less certainty. I think we've by and large done better with those more often than not.
Interesting. Okay. That's a little counterintuitive to what I would guess. That's fascinating. Why the holding co model? It's, I think, the last couple of years, and granted what you do and like the Amazon aggregators is very, the size, the scale, the level of maybe oversight, but the level of people really diving into individual deals per se is going to make things different. But why holding co companies when they do seem like they'd have, it's hard to run one business well, right? It's challenging. The most I've ever run at three at once was three businesses, and that didn't last very long because I thought I'm madman. I can't do this with any. So to go to nine in a holding co model, why take that approach versus just focusing on one or two and trying to grow those?
Couple thoughts there. And this is a question I get a lot. So thought number one is I'm only half the equation. So I'm the visionary CEO face of the company, the guy that gets to do podcasts. Justin, my business partner, he and I have been 50-50 for a long time. And I was kind of always the sales and marketing guy, and he was always like the ops guy. And as our careers have evolved, I've kind of become the strategist, capital allocator, face of the business, M&A guy, and he's really become the guy that runs the business. So he's the president, the COO. I have like 1.5 direct reports. He's got like 8, and the whole company reports to them through the leadership team. Like, he runs the business. I get asked questions from time to time that I don't even know the answer to, and he can rattle stuff off the top of his head, like orders today and customer shipments and customer service tickets. Like, there's just stuff I don't even know anymore that he does a really good job operating the business. He really is an operator, and I'm really more of a strategist. And so I think our business is kind of a reflection of our partnership, and we have this great relationship that I'm happy about and proud of, and it's served us and our families well. But our aspirations are really to build careers we would enjoy, a business we're proud of, and that business is the holdco, not the brands that we own, an environment where our team can thrive and that we can be proud to employ people here in Northeast Ohio. And if I had one business that I had the utmost conviction I could pour all of my resources into and get a better lifestyle, financial return, outcome in the world, I probably would. Our thesis really was predicated, though, there's these long tail brands that are niche by definition. And if you do a top-down analysis, go back to your investment banking days, like market size and market share, and you start looking at the dynamics of a competitive e-commerce world where we have bid costs for ads on Facebook, and we have SERP competitive dynamics with ranking algorithms, e-commerce is really pretty efficient. And there's only so much you can grow so many businesses until you really have to be highly innovative, highly disruptive. There's a lot of just good small businesses that just aren't going to grow ad infinitum. A $20 million revenue business might be as big as an e-commerce brand can get. And I want to be the home for a really great, wildly profitable, incredibly successful $20 million e-commerce business. I don't think I'm smart enough to force that thing into becoming worth 25, 30, 40 million of revenue. Maybe somebody else could. I don't think we will. And I think for most of those businesses, that might not even be possible. So we're trying to serialize the process of doing the repeatable, definable things across these businesses: supply chain, ops, HR, Shopify development, Amazon, pick, pack, ship, customer service. As time goes on, we need to break down the portfolio. We started like everybody did everything. And now the leadership team is very shared, but marketing is starting to get segmented. We've started to carve off brands that have like sub operating groups within the team. Customer service only does two or three brands per person, not nine. And so as time goes on, we'll sell off smaller assets. As time goes on, we'll buy more. And we constantly rewrite the accountability chart in the company to kind of better suit the needs of the business, because it is a constant juggle. There's always opportunity cost and always like a prioritization problem of what to do next. And we're constantly trying to optimize that. And yeah, it's a never ending puzzle and it's a lot of fun. And Justin is really good at it.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds, I think so many people, I think if you had to look at the number of people, so the visionary integrator is kind of an EOS thing, or it is an EOS thing. And I think there's more visionaries out there than integrators, at least effective ones. So cool.
There's more visionaries that do podcasts and talk on Twitter, but there's a lot of really great business people that are invisible. And if they would only join all of us on the internet, I bet you that there's a lot more of them out there that just aren't that public.
But you're right. How do you think about, you alluded to it a little bit, you know, like for customer service, you don't have one customer service rep trying to understand nine brands, which I think would be almost impossible. And you wouldn't be able to have a strong voice or a knowledge set. How do you think about that? Could you get a little more granular about how you break up the management, the oversight of those nine brands? Maybe do that across your other platforms, if you would. Like for supply chain, how do you think about that? Do you have one leader of each brand? Is there one person who oversees just an individual brand from a, they're the kind of the mini CEO of that brand that reports to Justin, for example? Or how do you give a little more detail? Because there's a lot of ways you could slice and dice that. I'm curious how you've done that.
So 2 years ago, there was only a shared services team. There was zero multi-layer, it's multi-entity leadership. It was one team, completely shared services. About a year and a half ago, we started the process of getting one brand ready to sell. And so now that business has a small team and has a general manager that reports to Justin. It was the first business we bought 6 years ago, probably more direct response than pure play e-commerce. It had gone full cycle for us. We thought it made sense to position it to be ready to get sold at some point. We wanted to have, it was big enough of a P&L to have a team, and we thought we'd want to sell it with a team. And so we had candid conversations with the people on that team about that initiative, and like we began that process. And so that's in motion. We're beginning to do similar work across the portfolio of even dividing the rest of the brands that we have into different portfolio groupings. And really, it's about the needs of the business. So a business that has complicated product catalog, in-house manufacturing, more revenue, and more orders and customer service tickets needs treated differently than a small SKU, make-to-stock, finished good that comes in and just gets inventoried and sold on Amazon. And so we try to kind of bifurcate the businesses by some of those operational levers that make more efficient use of the team's time. Our main interest is to really own those more complicated businesses that have the heavy supply chain lift, the more complicated manufacturing process, things that are a bit more of a moat that are defensible in the business. We think those are better kind of long-term assets for us as a holding company. And through time, I think those smaller assets will get sold off.
Interesting. I'd love to hear your take on Amazon. You have feels like Amazon is getting, there's this kind of, these two things that are happening simultaneously that seem contradictory, but actually are still both in the room. One, Amazon is getting harder, fees are going up, more competition, but then also more people are coming to Amazon because paid acquisition is getting harder on other channels as well. So you have an interesting, I mean, you've got 9-10 brands. How are you thinking about that right now? How do you think about Amazon as it relates to all the different brands and different strengths and weaknesses of each? Is there one size fit all? Do you put everything on Amazon, or is it really just depend on the brand? And how you think about Amazon long-term and how you're growing your business?
We've always been D2C centric. And for a while, I was pretty precious about it and looked down on Amazon sellers and didn't want my stuff on there. And I wanted to own my customer. And I had like this like soapbox I was on about it because I thought that was a good idea. I'd heard other people say that, sounded smart. So I'd repeat it. By the time I got around to the notion that Amazon was here to stay and should be part of our business model, we probably missed the land rush on Amazon in a lot of businesses. And the aggregator scene blew up. And like, I think we were a little late to coming around on that. Our view on it today is we're in long tail niche categories, and they will always have some demand we can create through content creation, Facebook ads, YouTube, putting media out into the world. And they'll have some amount of demand capture. People search on Google or Amazon for those things. And there's many marketplace dynamics of how many people search on Google and have a long purchase consideration and check blogs, and how many people just go on Amazon and want a prime buy now, it shows up next day kind of experience. And so we've been pretty open about being as channel diverse as we can, building the highest quality business we can. That's going to vary from brand to brand. Some brands do 50% of their revenue on Amazon, some do zero. And so it's really a function of the brand category we're in and the product line. I've gotten much less precious about it and much more focused on just building a really great business, and the sales channels will sort themselves out. Customers tend to vote with their wallet. And then the channels that we acquire customers on also have kind of competitive dynamics. Either people are or aren't looking for those things that we can reach through advertising, and the economics are going to shake out, and we're going to build the business in the direction of profitability.
Got it. Love to dive into financing a little bit. You mentioned no outside capital, use a lot of financing. You also mentioned a lot of high interest financing. And I'm guessing I'd love to hear how you've financed, particularly the acquisitions, but also like the ongoing ops, what's working well for you. Maybe we can start with acquisitions. And with SBA, I'm sure you've leveraged SBA quite a bit, but they have a cap there. Is it 5 million per person? Is that right?
Yep. We've hit it twice, paid it down and brought it back once. It was fun. Yeah.
Talk about, if you would, how you finance acquisitions and then also upside.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the keys that makes our model work is our capitalization. So Justin and I are highly risk oriented. We have young families, we have aligned values. It's easy for us to sign on the dotted line and want to own and operate our business and be independently in control. And so we've chosen not to raise capital for the business. And that's one of the reasons why our model works for us. It's optimized against our goals as founders. We are not obligated to a board or to a venture capitalist or a fund. Now that has some cons to it as well. Like, we are only accountable to ourselves. And so I think that sometimes the accountability of an outside party might be an interesting pressure on us as business leaders. But so far we've optimized for our flexibility. And that's been a key driver of what we've done. Because we're high risk and because we are optimized for our own flexibility, we've maxed that SBA. It is 5 million jointly between the two of us. We don't get 10, I don't get 5, and he gets 5. It's a combined cap. We at one point had the pleasure of being the biggest borrower on Kickfurther. It's an inventory finance platform that we borrowed 1.2 million or something, 1.3 million. Shout out to David there. He gives me a hard time about that still. I like to brag about being the biggest borrower. We've done all the things you shouldn't do. Shopify Capital, PayPal Capital, Wayflyer, all the expensive stuff. I know the math. I know it's expensive. To me, it is better than the cost of equity or not producing the revenue and therefore the profit on those orders. So we've chosen to do that. We would manipulate our balance sheet in ways that I wouldn't necessarily recommend to others. I would go finance inventory at 18% APRs that maybe mathematically get even higher than that if you do the math on a prorated monthly basis, as your friend Bill recently did on your podcast. I'd still rather do that and buy the business with my cash because I was able to leverage my inventory than not buy the next business. So we'd be really creative with how we moved around our working capital position, either through advancing revenue or financing inventory. That combined with the SBA financing, we've been able to cash flow everything out of retained earnings and the SBA cap, and then taking those high interest loans when need be.
That's awesome. How much has the jump from 0 to 5-ish% interest rates over the course of a year or so made the business model harder, the financing? Because I'm guessing some of those SBAs are, I'm guessing they're floating rate. But yeah. And also for new acquisitions, credit tightening, has it been a minor inconvenience or has it been a major change to the way you have to think about financing the business?
Interest expense has definitely gone up. We are, I think, about to round the corner on not needing any of the crazy high interest stuff here shortly. We're about to pay off, I think, one of the last tranches next month, which we're excited about. And we should actually be in a really strong balance sheet globally. Even with the raise in rates, it hasn't made a gigantic impact, at least that I can notice as an operator or leader looking at financial statements. Like, yes, there's more interest expense. We never were that highly levered on a cash flow to total debt or cash flow to payment ratio. And so you look at those kind of traditional financial measures of leverage, we're relatively modestly levered for cash outlay obligations to our lenders. And so yes, more interest goes out the door. No, that hasn't lost me any sleep or caused me to miss a paycheck or anything. Other things have caused those two problems, but not yet with interest rates.
Yeah. Thoughts on Kickfurther? I've always thought it is an interesting platform. And for people who don't understand Kickfurther, you go, it's kind of like crowdsourcing inventory. Correct me if I'm getting this wrong, Kelsey, but you go on, you say, hey, we need to place a PO for 500,000 in inventory. we can't get the financing. And so people will back you just like a Kickstarter project, but they actually technically, legally, I think own the inventory and then you pay them off as you go. And as you build up a profile and kind of a history, I think you can maybe drop from, you know, maybe 12, 13, 14% down to, I would guess, even maybe 10, maybe even slightly below that. Correct me all on those things if where I am wrong, Kelsey, but how have you liked that platform? Because I've always thought it looked like a really, it looked like one of the more compelling places to get reasonable financing for inventory. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, we like using it. Again, we've always had personally guaranteed debt. Kickfurther does require a personal guarantee, so it's never been a problem for us to layer that on. We've had a good working relationship with them. I think the cost of capital might be a bit higher than what you were referencing, but we've kind of made it into that successful enough track record in the community to probably get some of the better pricing on the platform. I was a backer on there years ago and thought it was interesting, so I went to the borrowing side. And yeah, fundamentally, you're right. It's consumers making a financial purchase of your inventory and then you buying it back from them at a premium, and it gets this imputed interest rate. Now you're looking at mid to upper teens, probably annualized cost of capital. Pretty flexible. And if you use a 3PL or Amazon, it's even better. If you have a direct PO to like Walmart or Target or something, it's fantastic. For D2C, it's pretty good. And I would prefer it myself to like the Shopify Capitals and Wayflyers of the world, because when a merchant cash advance lender underwrites your revenue, they're going to take a slice of all revenue. Whereas our model with Kickfurther had always been SKU-based. And so you end up, your repayment is based on selling those SKUs. And if you do have fluctuations, either early or late in that repayment cycle, we found some better flexibility there. And we've been fans of the product. Being very well aware it's expensive, by the way, but we like it.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at e-commerce fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is it's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has three big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast, on-point answers to your most important questions. If you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archive discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people if you're in e-commerce fuel. Our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes we'd be happy to share what they know. If you're, you know, traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, you know, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, you know, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into, avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us. ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7- or 8-figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply and potentially join the community. All right, back to the discussion.
Tell me a little bit about Akron. It's interesting. There's a group of ECFers that have these amazing, interesting businesses in the Midwest, in Missouri, in Ohio. I'm guessing, I know very little about Akron apart. I know very little about it in general, but guessing it's not a big tech hub. But it also seems like it's a cool opportunity to be unique, to be different, to be able to hire some talent or some people who have lived there that have roots, that want to stay. It seems like there'd be some very cool aspects about running a business like this in a place that people wouldn't necessarily expect. I used to get that all the time living in Montana, but there are some real benefits to living there too. So talk a little bit about how you think about how that's like the pros and the advantages of living in a place that wouldn't seem like it necessarily has advantages.
The cons would be the snow. The pros would be the summer is beautiful. I do love Ohio summers. Both Justin and I were raised here. We have family here. We never did like the laptop lifestyle. There's no option. As much as I'd love to live somewhere more tropical, it's not in the cards. Northeast Ohio is home. The Cleveland, Akron, Canton metro area is like 3.5-4 million population. Akron's in the middle of that. I've always actually lived in like Cleveland suburbs. Justin's always lived south of Akron down in the Canton area. And Akron is literally just halfway. It's like 35 minutes for me and 28 for him or whatever it is from our homes. We're pretty in-office culture. I'm in the office 3 or 4 days a week. He's there 5. Most of our team is there 4 or 5. And we settled on the middle ground. We do see some challenges in hiring. There's not a bevy of Facebook performance marketing talent. We've had to build some on our own. We've got good relationships with the local universities. We run an internship program. What we find, though, is that if you're not in one of those very specific like Shopify dev or Facebook ads categories, if you're adjacent and you're in brand marketing, supply chain, HR, ops, any of those kind of generic kind of business categories, we get the pick of the litter because we're the most exciting, most interesting thing in Northeast Ohio with kind of a cooler looking office that looks more like something you'd see on TV in San Francisco and less like working at the bank. And so we're kind of proud of that environment and the team we can build. I think it's compelling for people that are here that want a more fun place to work and an in-office experience. The challenge is definitely not a hotbed for e-commerce talent.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your culture, kind of piggybacking off that a little bit. And I don't have a lot of, I remember seeing on your 365 hirings page, it just seems like you had, culture seems important to you, even just the stuff that you said. What are the core elements that you really try to stress in building the culture at 365?
If you go back to a couple minutes ago, I made a statement, something along the lines of, Justin and I, the passion is the holding company. We're going to own these brands. The brands should be good and profitable, and they should create value for their customers. But I don't need to be passionate about any one brand we own and operate. Actually, if I was, it'd probably be a bad thing because I'd go like spend a bunch of time on it and distract people and they'd get pet projects and stuff. But if 365 is kind of the passion business for Kelsey and Justin, if it's the thing we're excited about, we thought culture would be a competitive advantage. We got some good advice early on in our careers from our executive coach around kind of the focus on that. We do run on EOS. You mentioned the visionary and integrator relationship. The values are part of EOS. I'd say for the first couple of years, it was a check the box. We're supposed to have them. It's on the EOS document. And there wasn't a lot of thought. And at some point, probably around 20 or 30 headcount, we started to shift that process. And for the last 3 years or so, it's been pretty forefront. So you go into the office and there's, you know, graphics on the walls. You go to the website or the job page. We talk a lot about the values. I think we want people that enjoy coming to work, that want to work hard and run a great company. And so the values, I think, reflect that. Culture day to day reflects that. We've had historically like great employee retention. And I think people generally enjoy coming to work, which is great because a lot of people in this world don't. And as founders, we want to enjoy coming to work. So we've optimized for a culture that we enjoy being at, and we want to attract other people that are on that journey with us.
Yeah. What's a day in your life look like? Like maybe we can use today, for example. I think I would love to just, if I could fly and just in bed with entrepreneurs for like a week and just be a fly on the wall and watch, it'd be so fascinating to see how different people solve problems, how they work, what their days look like. Because we all live in our own little worlds a lot of times, especially as founders, at least relative to other founders. So like today, for example, can you give us a sense what, obviously you're doing a podcast, but outside of this, what's on your calendar for today?
There's definitely seasons of life where that template kind of changes or ebbs and flows. I spend my time on strategy, big picture of the business, and worried about what's next. And so that shows up in a lot of ways, but to your example of the calendar, today I had a handful of one-on-one meetings with various leaders in the business. I have this podcast. I have a couple phone calls with external people that are not a direct revenue line item. It's not some key vendor. It's not a direct hire as kind of the face of the business, whether it's long-term relationship building with a lender or another e-commerce entrepreneur. I end up taking just a lot of phone calls and a lot of conversations to build the 365 brand and network and ecosystem because there's a lot of examples in our business where there's a very indirect, very non-obvious line between a conversation Kelsey had 6 years ago and this really great thing that happened today. And so I just make these really long-term investments and relationships, knowing that if we're going to continue to be in the game of entrepreneurship focused on e-commerce, having a great network is going to be really helpful. So And any given week, handful of L10 meetings using the EOS process, maybe a podcast or two if I'm lucky, and a lot of time working on problems, whether that's marketing related, finance related. If we're looking at new companies, I try to leave free time for deals and phone calls with sellers and lenders and investors. I get up early. I am one of those weird people that goes to the gym like first thing, try to take time to read, and try to get home at a reasonable hour and spend the night with the kids.
What time are you getting up every day, usually?
Usually it's at 4.
Oh my goodness. And what time are you going to bed?
Right after the kids, like 8:39.
Okay. That's impressive. Yeah. So you get up, you get the workout.
Yep. I've been a morning person, and just, I started at 6, then it was 5:30, then it was 5. Just, it's not any harder, at least for me right now at this stage in life, to like, I could definitely shift time back. I could get up later. I could stay up later, but the nights just aren't productive for me and the mornings are. So I just have shifted my life that direction. I'm always afraid it's some like badge of honor where people are like, oh, I got to get up at 4 because that's what this, you know, CEO of this holding company I podcasted. Like, it really is not that. It's just this phase in life, it is working for me. It's been working for a while. I don't know that I will always do that. I think right now it's a good thing for our life.
Yeah. You mentioned family, kids, and also risk tolerances. How do you think about the correct level of risk or debt or exposure? Like, how do you, and maybe there's not an actual calculus in your brain where you're running it in an Excel spreadsheet, but how do you balance those two things, you know, personally guaranteeing large SBA loans and financing, which is necessary for growing what you've built, but also thinking about the risk side of things, you know, if stuff goes south, is that something you, how does that conversation or that kind of that weighing machine work in your brain?
So we use a personality assessment here called Culture Index. I'm a big fan of it. And if you look at my risk rating on there, it's kind of off the chart. So I don't know that this is good advice for anybody listening that does not match that risk rating. I've never seen a risk I didn't like. Bit of an adrenaline junkie. Like, we go on vacation and my wife wants to read and I'm like, let's go scuba diving. Like, that's just kind of me. When I do think about that and I get kind of sober-minded about downside and protecting what we've built, in dark days, Justin and I have had the conversation that, you know what? If we together shipped the last package and shut the lights off, we'd both be okay. Like, the last check wouldn't bounce. We could survive this. Thankfully, we never come anywhere near that. But in my mind, like, really honestly, like, raw open answer as an entrepreneur is like, I could be the last person that ships the last package and turns the lights off and we'll be okay. And I'll figure it out. That's just where my risk tolerance is.
And Justin, I'm guessing, is a similar point on a risk vest, because I imagine it'd be very problematic.
Because I would not know how to use the software that ships the packages. So he would have to tell me where the tape gun is and where to print the label, because I wouldn't know how that works, but he would tell me.
Do you have, you know, a business like this? He's so instrumental for it. You're so instrumental for it. Do you have key man insurance? Like, if something, heaven forbid, happened where one of the two of you guys, you know, just something awful happened, do you have major insurance policies, given you're both so crucial to the business's future?
We've got a good bit, but now that you bring it up, we should probably have some more.
So yes, definitely sounds like. Yeah. Talk about a little bit about distressed. I mean, it's been a crazy year. Interest rates, like I alluded to earlier, and everyone knows, just went through the roof. The M&A market turned on a dime about, you know, maybe, you know, June of last year. At least in a lot of ways. And there's been a lot more distressed activity. And you, I believe, have done 3 distressed deals this year, looking at another one. Talk about what you're seeing kind of, you know, in that kind of not super transparent, more opaque world of distressed, especially for e-com.
I've got maybe a handful of observations. One, we've looked at a couple, we've not done any yet, but looked at a couple of micro cap public consumer products companies selling either primarily or at least a little bit e-commerce. That should not be public, that are very, very subscale. I've looked at a handful of these now, which I think is fascinating. The public markets were very kind to subscale consumer products businesses because all valuations were high. And as public market comps have come down and those businesses have had headwinds, whether that be performance marketing, whether that be supply chain or whatever it is, they are very opportunistically, many of them, looking at opportunities. So I've been looking at a lot of those, which is a fascinating world. We have done a couple of private distressed transactions with lenders. So if you have an e-commerce business, any business with a senior lender, and you enter the zone of insolvency, your fiduciary duty as a board or as an officer of the corporation shifts from protecting shareholders to protecting your senior secured lender as your obligation. So if you end up in an insolvent position and you have a lender, you're in communication with them. Cash is tight. We're burning cash in inventory. We have a problem. And those lenders will look for opportunities to work out that transaction. We are fortunate enough to do a couple of those with a lender this year. So if there's any lenders listening to this that finance consumer products brands and you have a troubled business, give us a call. Happy to look at it. My observation there is there's just been a lot of businesses that have been over-levered and over-financed, and it's a terrible place to be. Like, I have a lot of empathy and I feel bad for those founders that are in a tough spot because they have a lot of work to do and they're not getting paid and they need to like do well and have protect their reputation and protect people as best they can in a tough situation. And we're often a bearer of bad news and reality that can operationalize a solution for the lender, which is now first in line to get paid, but that might mean bad news to employees, bad news to vendors with balances. Like, it's kind of a rough scenario. We're willing to play that role. I think that we're good at it, but it's a tough experience. And if somebody thinks that might happen to them, my only advice would be like, head it off at the pass as early as possible. The more time you are in front of it, the more options you have and the less painful it might be. Waiting, if you're burning cash till the last minute, will just make it worse. I promise. I've seen a bunch of these now. The sooner the better if you don't think you have viability to raise cash or right size your business. Last observation that we've seen a lot of is just kind of venture-backed e-commerce businesses that have not hit escape velocity. They can't raise their next round. They don't have the proper unit economics, and they are not built for profitable, ongoing small business operations. Their goal was to be $300 million in revenue, and they made it to 18, and now they can't get anywhere else, and their balance sheet doesn't support that, and they need to be really right-sized. That type of business, in my hypothetical right there, maybe shouldn't even be run at $18 million. It might need to be run at $8 million to be profitable, and to shrink that P&L will be a very painful experience. I've looked at a couple of those kind of things. So my advice for anybody that is listening to this that might be concerned about their balance sheet or liquidity is get in front of it. Talk with your lenders early. If you need advice, find somebody like me or another ECF member, Maytab, to talk to. It's an interesting world of transactions, and we're certainly opportunistic and willing to look at a lot of things. I think we had the operational ability to go do some really fast problem solving for lenders or investors that need help. But it's been a really big learning experience for me. Some of the best transactions of my career potentially are coming through these distress scenarios. And it really speaks, I think, they take this conversation full circle about what are Kelsey and Justin building at 365. We're building a business in Akron, Ohio, that if a lender calls me on Monday, we could have the inventory here and the P&L right sized by Friday, which is hard to do, but Justin and the team have the ability to like very quickly go fix an e-commerce business. If it sells on Shopify and Amazon and we can get our hands on the inventory, we can probably like save some value there for the interested parties. And so that's an interesting operational capability that we're investing in and looking to take advantage of when opportunities arise.
How do you streamline? I mean, even just having with a very limited amount of experience I have with this, trying to have a funnel for looking at deals, evaluating deals. I mean, for every deal you close, you look at probably
99 more. Imagine.
Yeah, like it's crazy. And so, I mean, that in and of itself could be a full-time job. It is a full-time job for some people. So you're doing that on one side. You're also, you know, this year you said, for example, you bought three distressed companies and brought them in. That is another 2 to 3 full-time jobs, if not more. So my question is, do you have a dedicated part of your team for either due diligence or for integrations, or does it just, you just kind of, as they come up, you make it work with the specific roles in the company? How do you think about that? Because that's a lot of work.
Yeah. I think our org chart, specifically our leadership team and like the top of shared services. So VP of marketing, VP of finance, supply chain, chief of staff, HR, VP of ops, like the really core group of the leadership team that reports to Justin and that I sit in the leadership meetings with. That team has bandwidth. They have managers under them, and those managers have direct reports. Justin and I could, if we wanted to, very much reduce our leadership expense. Our leadership team is staffed for growth, whether it's organic growth or M&A. We have a leadership team that could run a business twice our size, and that leadership team's cost isn't half just because the revenue is half. And so I think we've invested in the infrastructure, whether it be managers, the leadership team, just the human beings that show up every day in Akron, that have the ability to very quickly pivot and reprioritize when it makes sense. Does that mean that something else doesn't get done? Like, yeah, we dropped some projects in Q1 because a better opportunity presented itself with M&A. Again, for us as entrepreneurs, it's a great fit. somebody else that says, I want to make the most out of my favorite business and I want to only run one, that wouldn't make a lot of sense to. But for us, trying to build the overall infrastructure, we're happy to investment spend in high caliber teams so that we have resources to deploy at a moment's notice for organic or inorganic growth.
I want to, before we wrap up here in a few minutes, talk about Holdingco Conf. I alluded to it at the top, but this is a, shockingly, conference for Holdingco owners or aspiring, or people who own an actual holding company with brands underneath it. I saw your demo reel when I was just doing a little digging before we hopped on. Looked amazing, man. The first year looked fantastic.
Thank
how
you.
Did give us a little, how did it go? What was the favorite part? What was the hardest part of the event?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Very proud of that. So a little more than a year ago, a friend of mine here locally named John Wilson, who has a business kind of like 365, but in the home services, so like plumbing, HVAC, we built a friendship, met online, and we're hanging out. And we both agreed there was not really a conference for holding companies. He could go to HVAC conferences and I could go to ECF Live, but the problems of a holdco are different than the problems of a single business operator. And we had begun to build some friendships and a network of other disparate industries, holding companies. And so we said we'd throw the first industry conference and see how it went. And the goal was like, don't lose money in year one. Very proud to report a successful year one. We're doing it again this September, but it's for entrepreneurs who identify as multi-business entrepreneurs, a holdco. I want to run a diversified group of businesses or a roll-up. We have everything from restaurants to boat tour operators to landscaping to manufacturing to SaaS to content to e-com. It's very, very diverse. It's definitely not an e-commerce conference, even though I'm like the e-commerce guy to a degree. Maybe 15 or 20% max of the attendees are digital. The other 80% are nuts and bolts, offline, brick and mortar, like traditional business models versus online focused. And again, the key is multi-business entrepreneurs, people identify as holding companies. And we're talking about topics you might imagine, M&A, financing, hiring teams, structure, strategy, but with that holding company context in mind. So yeah, it was a great event. Happy to run it again here in Northeast Ohio. And maybe for year three, we'll take it on the road.
Yeah. What are the dates for this year and how can people, if they're listening and they're like, this is my jam, how can they sign up?
Yeah. Thank you. Holdcoconf, CONF.com. Also, as part of promoting this year's conference, we're doing a Holdco survey. So Andrew, part of this I stole from you with the State of the Merchant report. I realized as I looked around, a lot of communities, a lot of events, a lot of ecosystems have somebody producing a report. I was like, scratching my head. I'm like, well, we have a conference. We should probably do the report too. So holdcosurvey.com. If you identify as a holdco, you can go there, fill out the survey. It's pretty lengthy. It's confidential. And we'll be sharing those results. I get a lot of value out of the ECF State of the Merchant survey. And so I wanted to do that same thing for the holdco community. Again, very disparate business models, but similar questions and challenges from holdco to holdco. That'll be a multi-year effort to get right, but we're excited for the first year of holdco survey. So that's at holdcosurvey.com.
And we'll link up to all of this stuff. First time conference, and I geek out about this. I just actually had a chance to talk with Tony from Seller Summit about conferences earlier today. So I'm getting a rare fill of being able to geek out with other event producers here. Best part of the event for you? What did you enjoy the most? And what was the hardest part of putting on an event for a first time?
I'll do these in the opposite order. I don't know if you remember this, but I texted you the day after the conference and said, you did not warn me about the post-conference adrenaline dump. My wife came to the closing dinner. She tried talking to me and I was like non-communicative. I had like no emotion, no expression. She's like, how's your day? And like, I should be on cloud nine. And I was like, I was speechless. I slept terribly. It took me 4 days to recover. So nobody prepared me for the experience of hosting an event. That said, very proud of like how it went. We had big plans. I'm happy to say they went well. No major hiccups. We showed off Cleveland. The weather was beautiful. Most people, you know, wouldn't aspire to throw a conference in Cleveland, Ohio. I think we couldn't be happier than the outcome. For people that are curious, so all the YouTube recordings are up for all the sessions and there's nothing gated. So if you want to go check out some of that education, there's a podcast feed, there's the YouTube channel. I was just proud that it went well. Like honestly, the best part, even though I couldn't enjoy it in the moment, was just knowing that it went well. We had people say nice things and we get to do it all over again. I'm going to try to chill out this year. Maybe take a Xanax. I don't know, but like I'm going to have more fun this year. First year was stressful.
Nice, man. Well, congrats on doing it. That's a huge, huge lift, especially your first year. I mean, it's not ever easy, but your first year, especially, man, you got so much stuff that you don't know, like anything. And again, I wasn't there, but heard great things and the demo reel looked fantastic. So
thank you.
Well done.
Appreciate that.
Well, we're going to do a lightning round here in just a minute. Before we do, can you give people the places to find you for a couple of things? One, we already talked about HoldCo.conf, but maybe particularly about 365. And most notably, if you mentioned if people are maybe struggling and they want either someone to talk to or maybe talk about if you can help them out of a tight situation, or if people just have a great brand that they're thinking about selling to a company, you also are in the market for those as well. So who listening do you love to talk to, maybe that you could help and be good to have that conversation? Where can they get that started?
365-holdings.com is a contact form there. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. About once a week, I talk to a founder or e-commerce entrepreneur of some size about any topic, growth, financing, selling their business, turnaround, whatever it might be. So like, honestly, no obligation. If you're listening to this podcast and you contact me, just say, I heard Jenny CF. And if you just want to have a conversation, even if it's not like near-term actionable, please buy my business today. Like, I'm just happy to connect with entrepreneurs. I think there is a lot of value I've gotten from people that were kind and helpful to me over the years. And if somebody reaches out and needs some assistance, I will do my very best if I can to provide them some help, even if it's not a financial transaction one day. So if you are curious or concerned, you want to reach out, just do so. And I'd be happy to chat with anybody.
Super generous. That's really nice. All right, let's jump into the lightning round here. So Kelsey, just I think you know how it goes. Quick, rapid answers here. And we got about 10 questions. So we'll jump right in. How would you describe the e-commerce environment in 1 to 3 words right now?
E-commerce environment right now in 1 to 3 words is professionals only. I think that if you have a good, strong business and you're running it well and you know what you're doing, it's not easy, but you can be successful. A lot of people had really strong first quarters that were great operators. People that maybe aren't up to date on the latest and greatest, they're not in ECF, they're not learning all the very best things and aren't on top of their business, have been struggling for a little bit.
One of the fondest memories from your childhood?
Touring the West with my dad. We went all the national parks, Zion, Bryce, all the places that are in your backyard there in the Southwest. But yeah, just touring the country.
That's how long of a trip was that?
So my parents divorced when I was young. And so I spent the summers visiting my dad at places out west. He had a fifth wheel and he would take a month off and I'd spend 2 or 3 weeks with him at national parks and just all over from California to Texas up to Wyoming.
Yeah, so I remember you telling me about that. That's cool. You live in Akron, Ohio, of course, right now. Where, if you weren't living in Akron, would you live?
Florida.
Any particular place in Florida?
As far south as possible. We just got back from a vacation in the Keys and all the conversation was about the 365 South office that we need.
Hardest part of your business?
Product innovation.
How much money in the bank is enough? You can either take it this one or two ways. You can take it the, if I had X amount of liquid net worth, this is money or, you know, stocks or just like liquid net worth in the bank or that I owned, or an annual income cash flowing every year. Like that it was just available in perpetuity. But what, which are one of those two, if you're like, you know, if I made more money, it'd be nice. But really, if I had this, this is all I would ever need. I'd be content. How much is enough?
I think 20 million. 20 sounds good.
How many hours a week do you work?
Depends on the week. Sometimes it's as little as 35. Sometimes it's 65 plus. It really just depends. It can vary kind of wildly.
Number one hobby, and you can't say work.
I'd say fitness broadly. So I've been a long time CrossFitter, but I sprinkle in a lot of other stuff. So started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu this year, often go running. We have a Peloton in the house. I like to stay active.
Oh, nice. How have you liked Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? I've got some friends who have their kids in it. You love it? Why? Sell me on it. Give me the pitch.
So I started CrossFit. I was out of shape and not good. And everything was aspirational. One day I'll do a muscle up. One day I can walk on my hands. One day I'll snatch 135. I did all those things. And then I got hurt a few times and I kind of rode the roller coaster of like functional fitness as a sport. I competed, not very well, but like I got to places I was proud of. And then I got to my mid-30s and things slowed down. It was hard to feel any advancement or achievement. The measurables were too obvious because as you get older, you start missing them. You're slower. You're not as strong. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu strikes me as a lifelong sport that I will be able to do for 10, 15 years and probably get better every year if I stick to it, because it is so complicated. And there's something just very visceral around being politely combative with somebody else on the mat.
Is it obviously a lot of work. Is it fun?
Oh yeah, for sure. I got choked out Monday night. It was great. I tapped before I went unconscious, but like I was getting strangled and I had a great time.
Do you do it with friends or kids at all, or do you do it by yourself?
So my son is in the kids class. My oldest is in the kids group before the adult session. And then I take him home real quick and head back for class and then open mat.
Got it. Very cool. And how long do you have to be in that before you start sparring? I know some things I've been in some other martial arts.
It was like week two I started sparring like very, very timidly. Yeah. Like with other white belts. The community here is very receptive to newcomers. Some of the coaches had experiences where when they were getting started, it was not receptive to newcomers and it was pretty, pretty brutal training. The training here is very safe and I feel very confident in my ability to safely go learn and practice and have a good time. And so is the other person.
Got it. Very cool. I may have to try this and been tempted to do it with my couple of my kids. So last question. What's one of the most, who's one of the most or more interesting people you've met through ECF? Obviously, I'm sure you can name a lot of people, you know, a lot of folks, but who's someone who just comes to mind that's like, this is someone I met through the community that just says I've gotten to know well or impressed by or just think highly of?
I'm going to go with Chad Carlton. I'm actually going to visit him next month. Some of the stories he's told about his warehouse operations are some of the most fascinating things. I need to go to Missouri for something. I'm going to go out of my way to go in early and spend a day with him and just see all this in person. I think he might be one of the best warehouse 3PL operators potentially ever. I'm going to go see it with my own eyes, though, to make sure that it's all fact. I'm sure that it is, but I need to go see this in person. He's been somebody I've really enjoyed getting to know.
That's cool. Well, Kelsey, thank you so much, man. Again, if you're looking to either sell your brand or could use some advice or some help, more in your tricky spot, reach out to Kelsey, 365-holdings.com, I believe. He's a great follow on Twitter. We'll link up to all the show notes. And then also, if you happen to hold a holding co, definitely need to go to his conference. There's, I mean, it could be no few, if any, places in the world you're going to be able to geek out with as much granularity on the holding co structure and the challenges and the opportunities that then at this place. And it's, I know Kelsey looked like an amazing event. You won't regret it. So Kelsey, thank you so much for joining. This is fun, long overdue. And man, just appreciate you coming on and also be a part of the community. You've been fantastic. So thanks for being here and being part of ECF, man.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Given you've made it to the end of the episode, there's a pretty good chance you're fairly serious about this e-commerce stuff, which is why you should check out the E-Commerce Fuel community. It's a vetted, vibrant community for 7- and 8-figure brand owners. And joining gives you access to a lively discussion forum for experienced founders sharing insights and getting help, access to our library of over 20,000 member reviews on everything from agencies to tech to lawyers to all the things that, you know, founders are making hiring decisions or purchasing decisions on to run their business, and invites to member events throughout the year. So if that sounds interesting, you can apply for membership and learn more at ecommercefuel.com. Big thanks to one-click upsell from Zipify Apps. Rapidly increase your AOV by offering targeted high-converting upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And also to Fulfill.io, an ERP designed specifically to streamline complex e-commerce businesses and the highest rated ERP among our community members. Learn more at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network live from New York.